Welcome back, my fellow peanuts, and welcome to anyone who is new to the channel or to my podcast. Now, this podcast covers true crime cases that may not be suitable for young listeners, and there may be graphic or violent content. So listener discretion has been advised, guys. So I seem to be picking some really well-known serial killers recently. I do promise to try and find one that is not as well-known, so this can be a really very a true crime podcast, guys. But today we're going to be talking about Gary Ridgway. Now, he was otherwise known as the Green River Killer. Our state is Washington, and welcome to episode 12, everybody. So there's a lot to cover in this episode, so let's begin. Gary Leon Ridgway, he was born on February 18th in 1945 to Mary and Thomas Ridgway in Salt Lake City, Utah. Now, he was the middle child, and the family would have three sons. His family would move to Washington when he was quite young, and the childhood home would be just off the Pacific Highway near an airport and near the Green River. Now, his playground as a child was the Green River area. Now, this would end up turning out to be his murderous stomping ground later in his adulthood. Now, Gary wouldn't have the easiest of childhoods. The older brother, according to a lot of reports, was really the favoured brother or the favoured child. Gary wouldn't do terribly well in school. He'd be diagnosed with dyslexia, and he would have an IQ of 82. Now, this is considered below average. His father was the meeker of the two parents, quite often not standing up to Gary's mum, but we're going to go through that shortly. But the dynamic was definitely the mum was a little bit more domineering, and definitely his father was a little bit more meek on the meek side. Gary would attend Chinook Junior High School and Taiyi High School. He faced a lot of challenges during his high school and his teenage years. He'd be held back twice. He would not end up graduating until he was 20. Now, there are some conflicting reports ranging from he was really well liked to he was severely bullied. But this conflicts later in his life a little bit, because he does seem to be able to form relationships and friendships quite easily. So that's a little bit of conflict for me. So I don't really know if that is accurate. Now, we're going to get back to his relationship with his mum. There are many things we can say about this relationship. From an early age, Gary would have conflicting feelings towards her. He would wet the bed until his teenage years, and his mum would mock and ridicule him for this. She would do some, what I would say, pretty questionable things. She would place him in ice cold baths as a form of punishment, and other times she would wash his genitals, which, let's be honest, that would create a lot of confusion for any boy who was just getting to that rather hormonal stage of his life. So he's just prepubescent and also pubescent sort of age. Now, he would sway between feeling like he wanted to kill her and being attracted to her. And Mary, their mum, would tell her son some pretty inappropriate things about some of her customers at work. Examples of this would be that the men had been attracted to her and how she really enjoyed taking their measurements of the pant leg. She was a seamstress, by the way, guys. Now, this would really confuse Gary, as he'd start to feel a little bit excited about her and what she was talking about. So that's pretty conflicting and not really understanding the dynamic, right? He would also bear witness to his parents' fights, and these would often turn violent, at least from his mum's end. And one time she would end up smashing a plate over their father's head. And just because their dad couldn't stand up to their mum, though, Gary's father reportedly was violent with his kids. I'm not sure if this information is accurate, but it definitely provides some insights into how he became the Green River Killer. In an article that I read, it said that Gary hated prostitutes. That feeling came from his father, though I think it's a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B. Gary would become religious later in his life and saw the women that he killed as a sin. But we're going to get to that a little bit later. I think with any dynamic where the woman is more domineering and the father is seen as meeker. And certainly in this case, and I'm not saying in any circumstances that it's not right for a woman to be more domineering or to be in the more leadership role and all that kind of stuff. I'm talking a very, very different dynamic. I think this creates for children in themselves a very difficult way to establish relationships with women and establish relationships with men. It sort of creates that men have to be in the powerful position and women should be meeker. I think that is where some of these feelings and some of this sociopathic behavior can certainly begin. But despite all the fantasies of wanting to kill his mum, he would never actually commit a crime as a juvenile. Not one that's been found. So let's be clear about that, guys. But he would definitely show signs of sociopathy. He would commit arson. He would wet the bed until his teenage years. It has been reported it was at least till he was at least 13, and he would torture animals. Now, these are the three triad signs of sociopathy. So it seems like even from a young age, he was already steaming ahead to become a psychopath. These signs seem to be missed by his parents, or were they too busy fighting to really notice? But the anger and resentment would bubble to the surface when he was 16 years old. Now, he would lure a six-year-old boy into the woods and he would stab him. The little boy thankfully did survive this incident. And the boy would ask Gary, "Why did you do this to me?" And he would reply, "I always wondered what it would be like to kill someone." Now, Gary wouldn't be linked to this incident until much later, as the child didn't know who he was and didn't attend the same schools. But he ended up getting away with this. But after finishing school, he'd marry his high school sweetheart, Claudia Barrows, and he'd join the Navy and he'd be shipped off to Vietnam. Now, during his time there, I think that's where he got his penchant, we will say penchant, for sex workers. He would end up getting an STD from one of the prostitutes. That still didn't stop his poor behaviour towards prostitutes or anything like that, but he certainly continued behaving in this way. However, the marriage to Claudia, that wouldn't last, as she'd admit to being unfaithful to him while he was deployed, and that really genuinely disgusted him, despite what he'd been doing. So I don't really know how he felt disgusted about what she'd been doing. After being honourably discharged, he would return to his hometown, SeaTac, where he'd get a job painting trucks, a job that he would end up staying in for almost 30 years. Now, he would marry for a second time, this time to Marsha Winslow, whom he would have a son with. I'm just going to stop and just have a little bit of a sip. Now, during this marriage, he would become really an extreme religious. Now, he'd even go to door and read the Bible to his neighbours and just around the neighbourhood. He started to really scare Marsha with this level of devotion, and Gary would insist that she needed to also follow all of the teachings of the Bible. There was also a flip side to this as well. He would be extreme in his sex life with her. He would demand sex in various public places and many times a day, or as many times as he could certainly get. So what he didn't seek though, when he didn't get his fill from his wife, he would actually go and seek out sex workers. This is not what actually troubled their marriage the most, though. It would be his mum and her controlling behaviour. Now, she would control their spending, what they would buy, what her son would be allowed to wear. It was just a real control over that marriage. And all of these things combined, they would be the end of that marriage, which would be over in around 1981. Now, this would be just around about the time just before all the killings would begin. He would marry for a third time, though, in 1988 to Judith Lawson, and he would be with her until his arrest. We are going to come back to her. Now, the killings would begin in 1982, but before I begin this, this podcast is going to be a little bit different in terms of timeline. There are 49 victims that would be found in various times and dates. So I'm going to go through when the bodies were found, and at the end of the podcast, I'm going to go through the victims, and that is the order in which they died. So there are 49 known victims, but the police actually suspect him of over 70. This is the map that I've got up onto my screen at the moment. It's got 44 victims, but that's actually now 49, but the map doesn't reflect all of them. So it actually shows you all the different dumping grounds that he actually had. So we're going to go through that. Now, Seattle had already experienced a serial killer, Ted Bundy. Now, he had already plagued the city, so the next time, or the next one, the police would feel like they could handle this one just a little bit better. I'm not sure that they actually did. In July 1982, the first body would be found. Now, over the course of 2 months, five bodies would be found in total, and little did the police know how many they were actually going to find in total and just who would be responsible. Gary would definitely have a type of victim. They would usually be prostitutes or they'd be runaways. It doesn't really focus on any physical features. It's more about the convenience and being able to get them alone and have that ability to be to get them alone. Getting back to our first body being found, though, two boys would be on their bikes along the Green River in Kent. They would notice something in the water and it would happen to be a body. The police would identify her as Wendy Cofield. She'd been living with a foster family. She left the house around July 8th and was never seen again. Now, it has been said that Wendy was a sex worker who would work on the Pacific Highway South. Now, she had been strangled, and it would appear, though, that maybe she did put up a little bit of a fight because her arm had been broken in the process. Almost a month later, another body would be found in the Green River, and she would be found completely naked, and this victim would be Deborah Lynn Bonner. Now, Deborah was also a sex worker, and she'd been missing since the end of July. Now, 3 days later, on August 15th, 1982, further three women had been found. They were all naked. Now, rocks had been placed inside these victims. I have a feeling to make sure that they didn't come back up, but they did. And these victims would be identified as Marsha Chapman, Cynthia Hines, and Oak Mills. Their cause of death also be strangulation, and some of these victims would be sex workers as well. Not all of them, though. The police would soon realise they weren't dealing with ordinary murders, and patterns were starting to arise. So they'd form a task force that was led by a Major Richard Kresge and Detective Dave Reichardt. Now, they'd seek out the guidance of FBI profiler John Douglas. We've spoken about him a couple of times on my podcast, and also the criminal investigator Bob Keppel. Now, he would compile most of the evidence that would actually end up leading to Ted Bundy being convicted. We're going to hear about Bob a little bit more here and there throughout this podcast, though. Now, there were some mistakes made at the start of the investigation. That's not a judgment. It's mistakes get made. So let's be really clear. These things happen. There was a lot of information to process, and again, it seems as though, like I've discussed on other podcasts, the victims weren't treated with as much care because they're seen as less because they're sex workers. But to be fair, this time the police did seem to like act on it really, really quickly. They put together a task force after five bodies had been found. I'm guessing the reason is that they didn't want another repeat of Ted Bundy. But when they realised that they were in trouble and they needed help, they would definitely go out and seek assistance from volunteers. Now, there were many, many crimes in Seattle at the time at the time of these murders. There was a man who was raping prostitutes at gunpoint. They originally suspected him of being the Green River Killer. This actually turned out to be another man by the name of Charles Clinton Clark, and he would have solid alibis during the times of the murders. John Douglas, my favorite FBI profiler, he would create a profile and he would say that the killer was confident, yet impulsive, middle-aged man who likely frequented his murder scenes so he could replay the murders and enjoy himself. Now, the killer, Gary, he would be familiar with the area and likely to be deeply religious. He does mention that the police may be active in the police force or police work, or he may even reach out to the police. So that happens. In September 1982, another body, Giselle Ann LaVaughan, she'd been missing for 2 months. She would be found near the SeaTac International Airport this time. Now, though she hadn't been found in the Green River, the police would actually believe she was a victim of the Green River killer as well, and she'd been strangled by a pair of man's socks. Between 1982 and April, so between September 1982 and April 1983, about 14 girls would disappear. These missing girls, they'd include Mary Meehan, Deborah Estes, Denise Bush, Shaunda Summers, Shirley Cheryl, Rebecca Moraro, Colleen Brockman, Gail Matthews, Andrea Childers, Sandra Gabert, Kimmy K. Pister, and Marie Melba. Now, most of these girls, they ranged from ages 15 to 23, but they were known prostitutes who had frequented that particular part of the Pacific Highway. Now, the first time that Gary Ridgway would be spoken to by the police in relation to one of the victims, that'd be in April 1983. Marie Melba, she'd gone missing after she got into the truck of a potential client. Now, Marie's boyfriend would follow the truck, as this was a process that they had both agreed that if Marie was going to be a sex worker. The boyfriend would see that the two of them looked like they were getting into an argument in that truck. And he would follow them, but he would lose sight of this truck and Marie would never be seen alive again. About a week after Marie had gone missing though, Marie's dad and the boyfriend would spot that truck again, or what they thought was the same one. And they would follow the truck all the way to Gary's house. And they quickly call up the police and then inform them. And the police would question and visit Gary's home. But no further action was taken because he said he didn't know who she was. He didn't know what they were talking about. So, not a reflection on the police, but like what a missed opportunity that was in itself, right? He's already at this stage, I believe, killed almost 20 women. And you've got him right in your sights and you just, it's just, yeah, just such a missed opportunity. In May 1983, another body would be discovered. She'd be found near the Maple Valley. That's about 20 minutes from the Green River area. Around 8 more bodies would be found in this area. I've got the map up again at the moment, guys, so you can see exactly where it is in the vicinity. This victim would be Carol Ann Christensen. She was 21. She's marked on the map as 22, but she would be displayed a little bit differently to the other victims. She'd have pieces of meat on her. I don't really want to get into it, guys, and what body parts it was in, but it was just really quite grotesque. But her cause of death was also strangulation. During this spring and the summer of 1983, 9 more young women, and many of whom were sex workers, would disappear again. These missing victims included Martina Warfley, Cheryl Lee Wimps, Yvonne Antosh, Kerry Roy, Constance Nayon, Tammy Lyles, Kelly McGuinness, Tina Thompson, and April Bartram. But in August 1983, Shaunda Summers, she'd be discovered near the airport. We mentioned her just before that she'd gone missing. And between September and December of 1983, 9 more women went missing. 7 more bodies were discovered, all of whom had been believed to have been abducted and murdered by the Green River Killer. Now, the missing women, who were mainly prostitutes, we're going to go through a number of them again, guys. It's Debbie Abernathy, Tracy Ann Winston, Patricia Osborne, Maureen Finney, Mary Sue Bellow, Pammy Advent, Delise Plager, Kim Nelson, and Lisa Yates. The body of Dolores Williams would also be included in the bodies that were found during this time, as well as Gail Matthews. And in October 1983, Yvonne Antosh and Constance Nayon, they would be found as well. Kelly Ware was found, but she hadn't been reported as missing. And in November of the same year, Mary Megan or Megan, she would be found. She was pregnant at the time that she had disappeared, and her unborn baby would be found with her. She'd be the only body that would be fully buried. All the other bodies were partially buried or had some type of covering or not buried at all. And Kimmy Kai Pasta, she would be found in a new dumping ground near Auburn. Up on the screen again, we've got that map. She's marked as 20, and you can also see that that's very near to where Gary was living at the time. In January 1984, the King County Sheriff's Office, they formally created a bigger task force this time to investigate the leads, and this time it was led by Captain Frank Adamson. Now, local law enforcement agencies, they included Port of Seattle Police Department, the Seattle Police Department, Pierce County Sheriff's Office, the Washington State Patrol, the FBI, and the Washington State Attorney General's Office. Now, they all contributed to this task force, but it was also at this time that another detective, Tom Jensen, would be assigned to the case. Now, in addition to the traditional tasks of compiling like paper trails on the suspects, detectives, they go to really massive lengths. They were searching for any physical evidence. They knew that this entire case might hinge on just finding a fragment that could have just been easily overlooked. But in February 1984, skeletal remains would be found and they'd be identified as Delise Plager. Now, she'd be the first body of this year to be found. Unfortunately, it by no means, it wouldn't be the last. The victims that would be found in 1984, that would be Cheryl Wims, Lisa Yates, Debbie Abernathy, Terry Milligan, Sandra Gabbett, Alma Smith, and Colleen Brockman. Now, patterns are definitely beginning to emerge that allow the police to just maybe magnify that profile a little bit more and get a bit better one. Gary had multiple dumping grounds, and with all of those bodies, apart from Mary Meehan, she was the only one who was fully buried. Everyone else had been partially buried or covered in things such as garbage. Now, the FBI profiler, John Douglas, he would remark that the killer thought of women as human garbage. Now, I do find this next part kind of interesting, guys. Ted Bundy would offer some assistance to Bob Keppel and the task force on who the killer was and try and give his own insights onto what this killer was like. He'd read a lot about Ted himself, would read from clippings that were provided to him about the killings. What he really wanted was pictures and more details that he didn't end up being allowed to do. Secretly, though, I think he got a little bit off on it. Ted would end up calling Gary the Riverman, and he would say that he was going back to those murder scenes and either performing necrophilia. Gary would argue that this is why he would partially bury those bodies so that he wasn't tempted to do this. But Ted would also say that he was performing sexual acts as he was remembering what he did. Now, his advice to the task force would be to stake out the new murder sites in case the killer returned. All of these insights, they certainly didn't lead to an arrest, but I think it gave them a lot to think about because, as you can imagine, they needed someone to tell them exactly what was going on inside that killer's mind. Now, two more bodies would be found, Mary Sue Ballo and Martina Offaly. The total body count so far would be 31, and 28 of those victims would be identified as victims of the Green River Killer. But 14 women were still missing at this stage. Now, over the coming years, more bodies would be found. But it was really in 1987 that Gary Ridgway, he'd emerge as a suspect. Not that he hadn't really been on their radar before that. In 1982, he'd been caught having sex with a prostitute, and he would be questioned in the disappearance of Kelly McGinnis, as there were reports that Kelly was last seen with him. In 1983, Marie Malvor's boyfriend, he would follow that truck and the police would get to question him. In 1984, Gary was arrested when he would solicit a police officer. Now, a sex worker would also accuse him of choking her, and this would lead to him actually getting a polygraph test, and he was that good that he passed it. These murders really slowed in 1985. We're going to get back to that in a second, but let's get back to 1987 first. Search warrant would be granted. The task force would find evidence when they were doing all of that massive, like, overhaul of all the evidence, and it would be tied back to Kenworth Trucking, where Gary worked. They would end up searching his home, his backyard, his work locker, and several of the trucks that he had access to. Nothing would be found, unfortunately, that would lead to an arrest. However, they were able to collect saliva. Now, his blood type would match two victims, but that wasn't enough to arrest him. That saliva is going to be their saving grace. Now, let's get back to why those murders possibly stopped or slowed down in 1985. He would marry his third wife, Judith. Now, she and him would stay together until his arrest, but during an interview, Gary would say that this relationship reduced his desire to kill and remark that he truly loved her and didn't need to find satisfaction elsewhere. I don't think serial killers just stop, ever, under any circumstances. I do think that there is a slowdown period. We saw it with BTK, we've seen it in other cases, but there is also an amplification, like Ted Bundy, like when he got caught and then he went off to Florida, he did a frenzy. So I don't know if it's really, it stops, or because he had so much going on in his life, maybe it genuinely did stop that desire, and maybe he only felt like he needed to do it every now and then. But I guess we'll never actually know, right? Now, in the late 1980s, the task force was reduced, and that was due to budget cuts. There was no concrete suspects and over thousands and thousands of man hours, right? It cost more than $15 million from 1983 to 1990 to run that task force. But again, guys, that doesn't mean they stopped looking for answers. They wanted to know who had killed these 40 women. In 1992, one detective remained working, and it was that detective I mentioned before, Detective Tom Jensen. But in April 2001, almost 20 years after that first body and murder had happened, Detective Reichardt, who was in that original task force, he was now the sheriff of the King County, and he would use and ask investigators to open up this case again and look at it through new eyes. We've got DNA now, and we've got all these things. So samples, they'd be looked at from murder scenes again, and lab work would start comparing to DNA. Now, I might add, guys, I know on TV shows it looks like, you know, you can get a DNA match within hours, but in the early 2000s, it wasn't quick, right? It was 6 months was your earliest. So 6 months later, in September 2001, semen samples that had been taken from Opal Mills and Marsha Chapman and Carol Christensen, they'd matched that saliva sample that they'd taken from Gary Ridgway. So the patience of these investigators was insane, and it paid off so well because they were able to tie that physical evidence to just one single suspect. I guess it's just, it shows you like that they never, ever, ever gave up. And around the same time, King County prosecutor, he'd be assigned as, there would be another senior district prosecutor assigned to the case. And on November 30th, 2001, he was arrested, and subsequently, Gary Ridgway was subsequently arrested and charged with the murders of Cynthia Jean Hines, Marsha Faye Chapman, Opal Mills and Carol Ann Christensen. In December of 2001, he was charged with four counts of first-degree murder of those people. So that was Marsha, Opal, Cynthia and Carol. His DNA would be found on the bodies of the women except for Cynthia Hines. The reason that they charged him with that one was due to the fact that she was found so close to the other victims, and they had no doubt that this person who killed her was Gary Ridgway. He would end up pleading guilty pleading not guilty to all of those charges. But that would all change in April 2002. Prosecutors would file a written notice to say that they planned to seek the death penalty. And over the next year or so, detectives and prosecutors, they go over all of the believed Green River cases, hoping to find any sort of forensic evidence to file all of these new charges. And they would send hundreds of pieces of evidence to be tested. Now, while this is going on in parallel, the King County Superior Court would put a charging deadline of the March 28th, 2003 to ensure that the trial would be done in a timely manner, right? So on November 5th, 2003, Gary Ridgway, he, to avoid the death penalty in King County, Washington, he would confess to 48 women, killing 48 women. And most of them had been murdered during 1982 to 1984. But the deal was that Ridgway made, he was to cooperate with authorities and closing out these cases in exchange for 48 life sentences without the possibility of parole. Now, his formal sentencing hearing would occur in January 2004, and later he would be given another life sentence after the remains of a 49th victim would be found. Now, guys, it was a reasonably short podcast in regards to this, but I'm going to go through all of the victims and the confirmed killings now. So at the time of Ridgway's sentencing, authorities had been able to find at least 48 sets of remains, including victims that had not originally been linked to him at all. And in the plea agreement, okay, he would plead guilty to any and all future cases in King County where his confession could be corroborated by reliable evidence. Now, next, guys, I am going to go through the victims and what little information I could find on them. There's not a whole lot, guys. It was the early 80s, so it wasn't a whole lot of information, but I think it's really important we go through them and we remember them. Now, Wendy Lee Cofield, she began acting out pretty much the moment she hit puberty. She was the youngest of two daughters, and back at home, her parents, they did attempt to put in those punishments, but she was really strong-willed, she was really short-tempered, and she was really impulsive, and it made it really difficult for them. And following her parents' divorce in 1979, her behaviour, it only got worse, with her mother describing her as wild in a lot of ways that I don't think a harmful kind of way. The only one she ended up hurting was herself. Now, she'd end up living with her mother after their divorce, but they struggled financially and often living in many low-income housing units and tents, and they'd pick blackberries in fields during the summer in order to find food. But after she dropped out of junior high, she would end up enrolling herself in school to catch back up. But by 1982, she was working as a sex worker with multiple run-ins with the police and drinking and doing drugs, allegedly, guys. But her mother would describe Wendy as a chronic runaway and someone who was running away from unhappiness and seeking excitement, or maybe both. But she was only 16 years old, so that's a shame. Now, she was his first victim. Our next victim is Giselle Ann LaVaughn. Now, she was the youngest child of an upper middle class family. She had an IQ of 145, so she did really well in school, and she was a really, really avid reader. Her favourite book was The Thornbirds, and she began to feel really isolated and started running away from home when she was 14. She enjoyed the Charlie Daniels Band and collected antique Jack Daniels whiskey labels. She was also a really devoted fan of the Grateful Dead. She loved the band so much that she followed their concerts all over the country. She would become involved at some stage with a taxi driver by the name of Jack, and he was older and very, very eager to have Giselle provide the financial support in that relationship. and that would result in her becoming a sex worker. And the two would stay in a small apartment in Washington State. It's really doubtful that her parents knew what she was doing for money. I think she was so smart that she probably found it difficult to relate to anyone in her age bracket. Now, Deborah Lynn Boner. So Deborah was 23 years old when she was last seen on July 25th in 1982. She was the youngest of three children. She went by a nickname, Dub. She grew up in a lot of poverty. She fell in with the wrong crowd. She would drop out of high school and she would begin abusing alcohol and really fought with her parents. After losing her job at the Dairy Queen, she failed a test to go into the Navy. She decided to try and start working on getting her GED, but she would meet a man by the name of Robert. He was a well-known drug dealing pimp in the Tacoma area. She quickly became infatuated with him, which, as you can imagine, she would end up having to work for the streets to support him. And the couple, they would live in various types of motels as they traveled up and down the West Coast and working those highways. She seemed to really, though, have a really good relationship with her parents, but things were tense around the time that she went missing. Arguments would definitely ensue when they'd speak negatively about her boyfriend. They would tell her, hey, he's a really bad influence. But despite all of those fights, she was always welcome in their home and she would make it a point to check in with them a few times a week and ending her calls with, I love you. And she was described by her mum as a kind-hearted and fun-loving. She had so many friends, black and white. She was good-hearted. She loved everybody and she'd do anything for everybody. So that's really sad. We've got Marsha Faye Chapman next. Unfortunately, there's very little known about her early life. She was an Arizona native. She was 31 and she was known by a nickname of Tiny by her friends. She was a single mother of three, ages 11, 9, and 3 at the time of 1982, at the time of her death. And she'd turned to prostitution as a way to support her family. She refused the services of a pimp. She said that she didn't want to have to share her earnings, and she was described as cheerful, outgoing, and someone who could really take care of herself. Now we've got Cynthia Hines. Like Wendy and Dubs, she was 17, and when she was 17, she dropped out of school and she ended up falling in with the wrong crowd. Her nickname was Cookie. And she got a job through a private contractor to paint apartments. And she would work with her friend Opal Mills, another one of Ridgway's victims. She'd been working as a sex worker, allegedly, since the age of 14. That is way, way too young as far as I'm concerned to be having any type of that. So we've got Opal Mills. There's no documentation of a 16-year-old being involved in any type of sex work or prostitution. So she grew up, apparently she was really pure-hearted. She was a loving child who named the dolls and the stuffed animals that she kept on her bed, like we all did when we were little girls. And she often went speedwalking with her mum. She was incredibly close to her big brother, and he would take it really seriously. But she would go missing with her friend Cynthia. And we've got Terry Milligan. Now, Terry was 16 at the time of her disappearance. She'd been a really, really good student and had dreams of attending Yale to study computer science after graduating. She was really active in her church as well. But her life would take a massive detour in middle school when she became pregnant. But she absolutely adored that baby boy, and she dropped out of school and she never had a chance to go back. But by August 1982, she was living in a motel with her boyfriend and was supporting the both of them as a sex worker. We've got Mary Meehan. Now, almost everyone that knew her would describe her as outgoing and vibrant. She was incredibly stubborn, apparently, and despite almost everyone in the large family having a having allergies to them, Mary would bring home stray cats and she'd hide them in her room. The persistent sneezing was usually her undoing, and she'd never really been a great student. She suffered from a hearing misperception that made concentrating really difficult for her. However, she was an incredibly talented artist who began to really rebel in middle school. And unfortunately, that would lead to her working in prostitution. And yeah, she'd been through quite a lot. But she would also call her parents and do a check-in. She miscarried twice when she became pregnant. She was experimenting with drugs, predominantly marijuana and LSD. But she was really trying to get her life back on track, because when she became pregnant for that third time, she had decided she was going to give this baby up for adoption, though she really, really, really regretted that decision. So she conceived yet again almost a month afterwards, and this would be the thing that would change her mind and would really turn her life around. She was planning on getting her GED. She was almost 8 months pregnant when she went missing near a Motel 6. So that's a heartbreaking story in my opinion. She was just, really, really heartbreaking. We've got Deborah Estes. Now, from the time Deborah was a small child, she was considered headstrong and a wild girl, and her mum found it almost impossible to rein her in. When she was 10, unbeknownst to her parents, she somehow managed to get a prescription for birth control from a Planned Parenthood office, and by 12, she would often run away from home after fights with her parents. And by 1982, Debbie decided to leave her family home, stole $250 from her mother's purse, and began living in various motels with an older boyfriend or a pimp. We're not really sure whether he knew that she was underage, but I don't think really pimps really, really care, like, I'll be honest. But when she was sexually assaulted by a man in September 1982, she would use the street name Betty Lorraine. She eventually agreed to work with the police in hopes of filing charges against her rapist. And she eagerly, she would testify. And she was last seen. After she testified, that was when she was last seen. But she was described as young, capricious, many friends who adored her, and she loved horses. She was only 15 years old. Linda Rule, she was known as Janie, and she had a background that's all too familiar with our victims, guys. She dropped out of middle school. She left home at the age of 14. She was the occasional drug user, mainly, to be honest, it says here, Ritalin and marijuana. She would end up using, so she would need to financially support herself. So when she was 16 years old, she would leave that motel room and she appeared to be in a really good mood. Things were finally looking up. She and her boyfriend, a 24-year-old Bobby, were recently engaged, and she'd really hoped to have a regular and normal life. She really wanted to be away from the life of the sex worker and stuff like that. She really wanted to do something different with her life. Now we've got Denise Bush. Now, unfortunately, there's very little information on this 23-year-old. She was a Portland native, and she was an experienced and fairly cautious sex worker who often traveled to Seattle where the money was better. And at some point during her young life, she had a medical procedure involving her brain, and her skull had a small hole in the bony process there, and she also suffered from epileptic seizures, and these were controlled by medication. These were the only things that she really, really talked about, and she traveled at some point up in 1982 to visit her boyfriend and went missing. Shonda Summers, there's very little information on her as well, even though her birthday appears to have been lost. She was born in sometime in 1965. She had a history of prostitution. She was only 17. She was last seen along the Pacific Highway when her sister gave a victim impact statement, she said, "The same lives that you took seem to be the same lives that are saving yours." I find that very ironic. That was in reference to the plea deal that would spare him from the death penalty. Now we've got Shirley Cheryl. She was 18 years old. She was once on the drill team. She loved to dance. She's the oldest of three daughters. And she grew up in a really tight-knit family. And she was working as a sex worker by 1982. We've got Rebecca Moraro. She was born in August 1962. There's not much information on her early life, but it does seem like she was close with her sister and her mum. And later she would have a daughter. She began supporting herself as a sex worker. She would sometimes think that it would be better if her baby had been adopted by her mum, and she would end up bringing her baby and saying to her mum and saying, "I'm going to be gone for a long time. I can't take a baby." She was a really good friend of Deb Estes, who was also a victim. Now, Colleen Brockman, she was 15 when she disappeared. She'd run away a few times before, but she was living with her father and her brother in Seattle, and she would usually return after a few days, but she didn't return after one time. But this time when she ran away, she took a few things from her family home, all her clothes, all her Christmas gifts, the family stereo, and some money. Now, her father would file charges on her to seek a warrant, but he would never see her after that time. Now we've got Sandra Major. There's little information again, but that would be perhaps at the request of her family. She'd been known as Jane Doe B16 or Bone 16, but she was found in 2012 after one of her cousins had actually seen a special on the Green River Killer, and they actually submitted their DNA because they wanted to know whether that was, you know, their family. They were well aware of her lifestyle as a sex worker, but they just wanted her to come home. Now we've got Wendy Stevens. She was known as Jane Doe B10 or Bones 10. She's known as the youngest victim. She was only 14. She ran away from Denver, Colorado. They believe that she wasn't killed. She was killed shortly after she arrived in Washington. But in early 2019, one of her parents had taken a DNA test and uploaded the results to the GED match, hoping to learn what had happened to their daughter. They did. Alma Smith, she was 18 when she disappeared. She was a former resident of Walla Walla, Washington. She dropped out of school at the age of 17, and she'd go back and forth between her mother and where her father resided. She turned to sex work at some stage of her life. She went to a health center, and she was receiving counseling, but she would return to the life of prostitution, and then she would unfortunately die. We've got Dolores Williams. She was born in June 1965, and she was aware of what was going on with the Green River Killer, and she was very, very cautious. She would end up working in wealthy areas as a result. Now we've got Laurie. She was known as Jane Doe B17, and she was known as Laurie Ann Ripwitz, and she was known as a runaway. Gail Matthews. Gail just grew up way too fast. She was a California native. She moved to Washington in 1975 to live with some friends. Now, after giving birth to a little baby boy, she would give him up for adoption, and she would marry a man by the name of Kenneth Matthews. They would separate in 1980. And they'd have some daughters, and they would share the custody. But she'd gone from that lifestyle, and she would end up moving into sex work. And she would see her daughter as much as possible. But unfortunately, it really didn't. Yeah. Unfortunately for Gail, it didn't end well for her. She ended up with a sex worker. And yeah, it just seems a really common thing, guys, of all these victims, that they just had it really, really tough. And they all went missing because they were sex workers or runaways. Now we're going to talk about Andrea Childers. She was 19 the last time she'd been seen by her grandmother. She came for a late birthday celebration. She was wearing a beautiful dress. She was wearing a long grey coat. She'd been baked a chocolate cake. She kissed me like always, and then she left. She'd been a native of Southern California. She moved to Seattle in some point in 1980 to live with her father and stepmom. She'd been really close to her grandmother. She wanted to be a dancer, and she gave lessons, and she was really good, and she taught dance exercise. Now we've got Sandra Gabert. By 1983, 17-year-old Sandra, she went from being the star of her basketball team to working one of the most dangerous corners on the Pacific Highway, and she reportedly dropped out of school because she was bored, and she was living in a motel with her boyfriend. Seems they were quite frivolous with their money because she would have to turn to sex work to support them, and they were barely able to afford their motel room and their fast food. But she was described as a confident, free spirit that was charming, and she always gave the impression that she didn't take herself too seriously. Now we've got Kimmy K. Pista. Within 16 hours of Sandra's last known sighting, Kimmy was seen for the last time in downtown Seattle. She was described as an adventurous girl who loved unicorns and anything purple. We've got Mary Jane Malabar. She was 17 when she moved out of her family home in 1983, and she was working as a waitress in a restaurant in which her father owned. So she was really popular because she was so friendly, she was outgoing, she loved to dance, and unbeknownst to her family, she was also working as a sex worker on the side. Carol Ann Christensen, she was last seen leaving the Barn Door Tavern. While she was walking in the area, she was not a sex worker. She'd actually just finished lunch at the tavern and planning on returning there for her shift as a waitress. So it'd be her second day on the job. She would marry a man by the name of Dennis Christensen in 1980. She was a young mother, though. She'd just recently separated from him, and I'm guessing just a really unlucky situation. Now we've got Martina Ortholi. She was 18. She was born in West Germany, but her father was stationed there because he was in the US Army. The family returned to Seattle, Washington. She would go to high school. She'd even join the Army's National Guard before being discharged before 6 weeks worth of training was up. Now, Cheryl Wims, she was the youngest of four children, and her mother, Ruth, was a nurse. Ruth, this wouldn't be the last tragedy. Years after Cheryl's disappearance, her sister Deborah, a sex worker, she would go missing under fairly similar circumstances. And while Cheryl did have a drug problem, her mother couldn't picture her working in anything like prostitution. And the worst part was she didn't know Cheryl had even gone missing from school. Yvonne Antosh. She came to Seattle from British Columbia, and she'd been staying in a motel with a childhood friend. Now, Carrie Ann, she lived in multiple group homes. She had said that her stepfather was sexually assaulting her, but people were not entirely sure whether that was the truth because she was known to create stories, but she did unfortunately have a history of prostitution when she went missing. Now we've got Constance Neon. She was last seen by her boyfriend in 1983. She informed that she was just going to go pick up a check her job, and she'd see him in 20 minutes. She was never seen or heard from again. And Tammy Lyles, she was known as Jane Doe B20, and DNA would identify her. Now we've got Kelly Ware. There was little known about her, but all we know is that she was last seen in 1983. Tina Thompson, 21-year-old Tina's birthday has seemed to have been lost, but when authorities contacted her family, they disclosed that they hadn't seen or heard from her in years. April Buttram, this is a story we've all heard. She changed from an obedient child to a rowdy teenager who quit school, experimented with drugs and alcohol, and all she wanted to do was party all the time. She seemed eager to leave Spokane since her family had moved there, so eager that she couldn't even wait for her 18th birthday, in which she would collect $10,000 of her trust fund. And one night in 1983, she was planning on catching a ride to Seattle with two friends. Her mum had caught her crawling out of her window. carrying a suitcase, and her mum said at least had the guts to go out the front door, and she did, and she never came back. She would be found in 2003. Now, Debbie Abernathy, she arrived in Seattle just weeks before her disappearance, and she'd come from Waco, Texas, with her boyfriend and her three-year-old son. The family was quickly out of money and had been living with a kind-hearted couple that they'd met at a down-and-out store until they could get on her feet, but she'd be found. Tracy, she would be a runaway. She'd meet an older man. Her mother, imagine that, detested him. But again, she would support him by going into sex work. She would end up calling her parents from jail and saying she would never want to do that again. And then unfortunately, she would disappear from there. We've got Maureen Finney. She was described as shy, emotionally immature, and naive. One of her eight siblings, she didn't even date in high school, and she had expressed many suicidal tendencies. Maureen was living on her own in a small apartment. She'd become somewhat of a social butterfly in her later part of her life and was in a first serious relationship, but they were struggling financially, and she turned to sex work because they were planning on moving to California. Mary Sue Bellow, she was a treasure to her family and liked by all that knew her. That's all I have on her. We've got Pammy Avent. There's little known again about her, but she was a sex worker who would travel between Portland and Seattle. She'd been last seen in late October 1983. She was only 16 at the time. She would be found in 2003. Delise Plager. It had been really difficult. She just had a difficult life. After barely surviving her birth, she always went by Missy, and she spent her formative years with her parents, who were ill-equipped to properly take on the care of her and her twin brother. And they were moved into foster care. And things began to look up about in 1982, though, when someone approached her and said she was so pretty that she could basically be in a movie. She would end up being separated from her brother in her childhood, but they'd end up reconciling at a period of their life by about the age of 17. But Missy had developed a drug problem and unfortunately, as a result, became a sex worker. So she had many problems. We've got Kimberly Nelson. 21-year-old Kimberly Nelson, she went by nicknames including Star and Tina. She was from Ann Arbor, Michigan. She dropped out of high school in her junior year. At some point, she'd developed a heroin addiction and ended up in Seattle. And by 1983, she was a sole financial support for a pimp, and she wasn't worried at all about the Green River Killer, and she happened to be 3 months pregnant when they found her body. Lisa Yates, 19-year-old Lisa, she'd been shuttled from home to home from very much a young age. She would eventually go live with her sister's family, and she was absolutely adored by her niece, Veronica. Mary West, she'd been last seen in the area of Rainier Valley, and she was living with her aunt and was described as a quiet girl who was always thoughtful about coming home on time. But she was dealing with a serious problem. Only a handful of people knew that she was 3 months pregnant, and she didn't know what she was going to do about it. She was only 16 when she died. Cindy Smith. It's unclear, though, if Cindy had really gone through that rebellious phase. Either way, she left home at the age of 17, obviously much to the concern of her mum. But Cindy had called just before she went missing. She called her family and said that she'd been happily engaged and she was going to return home to celebrate. Patricia, she was 19. She was a sweet child who often goofed around and put olives on her fingers. She'd been a recent graduate of the culinary school and she dreamed of owning her own bakery. She'd been described as a tad gullible when it came to men, but her life was definitely on the right track. And she'd go missing in 1986, but she'd be found in 1983. Roberta Hayes, otherwise known as Bobby. She wasn't allowed to be a child. She was forced to grow up really early as her mother faded in and out of her life. She was pushed to do all the cooking, the cleaning, and taking care of her a pair of twin brothers and a younger brother as well. She was feisty. She was just like a really, really good and kind little girl who looked after her family as much as she could. She would have her first baby at the age of 15, and by the age of 21, she actually ended up having five. But all of her kids were placed in the care of the state, and were adopted out. Despite living on the streets, she always came home for holidays and birthdays. She'd go missing in 1987 and be found at some point in the 90s. Marta Reeves, there's little known about her younger life, but by the time she was 36, she'd been separated from her husband and four daughters, and she was participating in sex work to pay for her crack cocaine habit. Court records show that she'd been arrested for prostitution, so that's really unfortunate. But we've got Patricia Yellowrobe. She was the eldest of 10 kids. She was a part of the Chippewa Creek reservation in Montana. She was very much adored by her family. She would often look after her blind grandmother. She would often be seen as the eyes for her grandmother. By 1998, though, when she was 38, she was living a pretty precarious and unpredictable existence because she was struggling with a really bad drug habit before she was found murdered. Now, that's 49 victims that I went through, guys. You've seen at some point across the videos that I've got their pictures up. I want us to always remember the victims first. But thank you all so much for listening to episode 12. If you like this podcast, please hit that like button, subscribe, and go and listen to any other episodes. If you're new, have a great weekend, my fellow peanuts, though. See ya.